Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. So we're moving along through our winter retreat. It's about just a little over 3 weeks left. Overall, you know, I think people are practicing diligently, putting forth effort, you know, something to be delighted in, using this time for allowing the practice to settle and people to mature in their practice. You know, with 3 weeks left in the retreat time, and it's always helpful to be clarifying for oneself or to reminding oneself what the fundamentals of the practice are. You know, it's easy to get swept up in trying to, and not that it's a bad thing, but, you know, but trying to make the mind more peaceful, trying to get more refined states of stillness, trying to realize insights. And I say, that's a good thing, but there's also a problem with that as well, in that desire for gaining, becoming, it's fraught with dukkha as well. And of course, I'd rather encourage people to be diligent and seek, you know, more settled, clear states of mind rather than to goof off and make a lot of problems for each other. You know, you have to be attentive to how we pick things up, you know, with that. Because we have such a strong sense of trying to achieve, trying to accomplish, trying to gain, trying to get, trying to become something, a good meditator, good practitioner. You know, we can torture ourselves with the practice as well, to be attentive to that. You know, it's interesting to reflect on Magha Puja was just this past, just a few days ago, commemorating the occasion when the Buddha taught, there was a gathering of 1,250 arahants, and then the Buddha teaching these 1,250 arahants. You know, the Buddha didn't sort of give an all-night discourse on the subtleties of emptiness and the refined nature of the non-self perception. Do good, refrain from evil, purify the mind. So he wasn't really talking about it. He wasn't coming up with a view, something for you to hold as a view. He was giving you something to do. Because we tend to try to, it's like take refuge in, you know, either some kind of state or some kind of experience or some kind of view. And what is more, I think more powerful, is actually getting down to just doing the practice and doing the refraining from all the unskillful, the unwholesome, actually doing it, you know, rather than having an idea about, you know, when I become enlightened, then I'm going to refrain from evil, you know, sort of thing, you know, that. But that's tomorrow. So, you know, today's, you know, oh, well, we'll see what we can get up to. And same, you know, the doing of good. You know, so yeah, well, I'm really going to be a good person when I get my meditation together and get my. You get a real consistent run of samadhi. It's not quite happening yet, but you know, maybe, you know, tomorrow, next week, next retreat. It's not really happening this retreat. that sense of you know, the mind going to, yeah, some view, some proliferation, you know, and that's and it's interesting that what the Buddha. One of the like the word for proliferation is papancha, and a synonym for nibbana is nipapancha, a sort of non-proliferation, non-complication, non-objectification, and because we that propensity for proliferation, and you know how we entangle ourselves in the mind proliferating, and nipapancha isn't just sort of desperately trying to squeeze the mind so it doesn't proliferate. It's really seeing things clearly, seeing things in their true nature, understanding the fundamental truth of experience, and you know that is the recollections of impermanence, unsatisfactoriness, not self, reflections on the conditioned nature of our existence. This is so fundamental to the practice, so that we really can allow the mind to slow down, to stop. Again, not because we're forcing it or trying to make it conform to an idea that we have of it, but it's through clarity, through that quality of knowing. And being the one who knows, and it relies on that development of mindfulness, and the mindfulness not just being a technique, but a willingness to be with what we're experiencing, a willingness to be attentive, to be present with what we're experiencing. And again, this is where tuning into what is it that makes the mind or entices the mind to proliferate, to objectify. It's that wonderful sutta, the honey ball sutta, the sweet morsel. How's it go? Started with using the sense basis as the example, and of course starting with the eye, and dependent on eye and forms is the arising of eye consciousness. The meeting of the three is contact. Dependent on contact, or with contact as condition, is the arising of feeling. The arising of feeling, there's a, you know, or what one feels, one perceives. What one perceives, one thinks about. What one thinks about, one proliferates. With what one, with that proliferation, based on these perceptions and feelings of the, you know, one is then beset by these proliferations based on feeling and coming from the past, future, present. And so that there's a, and it's interesting that there's a, and I can't remember the grammar of it, but there's a, within the Pali grammar, and there's a, it's sort of like each of those steps is quite ordinary, but then it comes back on it. At the point of that proliferation, then it comes back and bites itself. You know, basically, and it's beset. We're beset by that these proliferations. It's not a problem to have eye, you know, the eye and forms and consciousness, or for there to be contact, or for there to be feeling, or for there to be perception, or even for there to be, you know, what one, or, you know, what one perceives, one thinks about. Even to think about it, it's not really a problem. Problem is the objectification, the proliferation. And the conjectures, the worries, the assumptions, the liking, the disliking, the wanting, the not wanting. There's where the problems are. It's of the proliferations. Like, then we're beset by that, and whether they're from, you know, past, present, future, it creates a problem. Of course, the same for all the sense bases. So that learning how to be attentive, to be mindful of this, the experience of having a body, having a mind, having senses, that their function is to actually, you know, the function of the eye is to see forms, the function of the ear is to hear sounds. I mean, it's their eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, mind, and they have their functions. It's just ordinary, it's normal to experience the things around us and internally what we experience. But then to take it and proliferate from it, to objectify it, to create a sense of me, self and other, of me inside and outside, past. These are the complications that we're beset by. And it's, you know, some on a certain level, you know, it's actually, you know, it's actually quite, you know, a simple thing to be free from them, from all of it. It's the, you know, the problem is of course we not, you know, we don't just believe in the proliferations, we're addicted to them, you know, that kind of addiction and craving inability to do without it, and to delight in non-complication, in delight in nipa-pancha, is something that we're unfamiliar with. So particularly in a period of time like this of retreat, to be directing attention, being mindful of, you know, how can I allow this quality of non-complication, non-proliferation to manifest? And it isn't through forcing it, which is another proliferation. It's through being mindful. And having, of course, having right view, is having a fundamental view that allows that to be a possibility, and reflects and investigates things from that sense of seeing things in their true nature. You know, these fundamentals of refraining from the unskillful, doing all that is good, and purifying the mind, these are this is something we can do, something we can, because there is a certain, you know, we're all, we don't actually have much control of our human existence. Despite the, say, the great American way of, I think you get what you pay for, but the actual control, you know, we have no control over our bodies, and they just keep aging. They get sick. They don't even consult you. Don't ask. The mind very limited control, really. We would like to be peaceful, and we keep, you know, we keep trying. We'd like to think good thoughts, but. You know, it didn't take very long, and some, you know, some sort of weird perverse sort of demon shows up on one's doorstep. Thoughts are, you know, there's not a huge amount of control. Now we'd like to, you know, have any control of whether will be praised or blamed or receive criticism. There's no real control over that. No control whether we'll be liked or appreciated, disliked and reviled. Not really. Now those are all, but what we do, we can actually put some, our attention or effort at control is more in terms of the actions, refraining from evil, refraining from the unwholesome, doing what's good, purifying the mind. These are things that we can exercise a bit of control. This is a sort of karma. These are the taking responsibility for our actions. Everything else is really kind of under what do we say in the Buddhist cosmology, it's Mara's realm. It's sort of the Lord of Death has control, and there's just being able to recognize the realities of the human form. This we're in a finite form, subject to aging, sickness, and death, and to actually see that, assumptions that we have about it, or the difficulties that are inherent within that, to be able to make that conscious and then use it as a catalyst for the arising of wisdom, for the arising of compassion, rather than trying to exercise control or be frustrated or deluded by things. So there's a great story, whether it's true or not, but it's a story of General Franco. He's the president of Spain for like 40 years, came to the power in the 1930s, managed to exercise control all the fighting factions, and ended up seizing control of the country, managed to maintain himself as a military dictator, country 40 years. He's in his 80s, and he finally died in 1975, mid-1970s. And, of course, he got old and sick, and was in his 80s, and he's dying on his deathbed, and he was a fixture in Spanish society and culture, so that when it came to his passing, everybody sort of knew he was getting weaker and sicker. And people from all over the country, the city, come out. And of course, you lived in a big palace, and they're outside the palace, and they're coming to sort of pay their respects, and they're outside sort of chanting, "Farewell, Franco, farewell, Franco, farewell, Franco," and this old sick man, still the dictator, he could hear that, and he asked the people, close to him, like nurses and whoever was there around him at the time. You hear the "Farewell, Franco," and he said, "Farewell, Franco." He said, "Where are they going?" Just the idea of not being in control just wasn't there. And it's taking these realities and being familiar with the nature of the body, nature of the mind, and being able to look at it closely. What can we do, and how do we do it? Because those are two aspects. So that being able to reflect on the reality of the body, the mind, the world that we live in, and then how to live in it in a way that is free from remorse, free from complication. It's such an important question to be asking ourselves, because we can. We can take this spiritual quest, spiritual practice, and we can complicate it. We can look at the body and make it a complicated thing. We can look at the mind and make it complicated. To being able to see things clearly, see the reality of things, learn how to be free from remorse, free from complication, and keep on track. In a couple of weeks, I'll be going to a funeral ceremony for Ruth Dennison, and she's very well-known, well-loved teacher. She's aged when she passed away. Just a week or so ago. She's 92 when she passed away. And she, one of her, gifts for for her funeral ceremony, she specified, made it absolutely clear, open coffin ceremony. She's there teaching right to the end. Until we carry her to the crematorium. And it's really wonderful, because it's these realities are, it's so important to see it clearly and to not complicate it. The nature of of our nature of awareness, to be attentive to how we hold that awareness, because that's just is looking at the true nature of things, and then not complicating, and to be attentive to what those pulls are, because there's a there's a natural pull to distorting perception. This is what the Buddha called vipalasa, distortions of perception, and we seeing the permanent, stable in the impermanent. It's a distortion that we're not attentive to the unstable, in sort of changing, uncertain nature, inconstant nature of phenomena. So that to pay attention to that distortion, and because that's what the mind does. That's what delusion does. That's what avijja does, a lack of true knowledge. It looks for the happiness, the comfort, the pleasurable in dukkha, in what is unsatisfactory. That's what it does. That's what the nature of this distorted perception. It tries to see the self in what is not self. It tries to see what is attractive in the essentially unattractive. Because that's what the mind, the heart, that is still immersed, still tainted with greed, hatred, and delusion. That's what it wants to. It distorts experience in order to try to get stability, try to get pleasure, try to get some foundation for a sense of self, a solid me, and looks for the attractive, the pleasing. And it's not that the Buddha is trying to make us miserable, but what he's trying to do is allow us to experience the happiness of that is actually grounded in what is not distorted, or what is not complicated. And the Buddha very explicitly say, like speaking about say Nibbana or the goal of, equates it with the highest happiness. Nibbana paramang sukhang. Nibbana is the same unequaled, unequal happiness is the highest bliss, but one has to experience things without distortion in order to experience that. One has to experience without that complication, proliferation, objectification, and being able to simplify and keep things really direct. Keep it simple. So particularly as we're moving into the latter part of this retreat time, and we had the opportunity to build up momentum of a practice and mindfulness and reflection and clarity to be able to apply it skillfully. And don't let it get distorted. Don't let it get complicated. There's a story in the Tibetan tradition of where this well known teacher, the Geshe, sees his student, circumambulating at the gompa, at the shrine, at the monastery, and it's a traditional practice. Doing circumambulations, of course, we did it. Just did it to Magga Puja. We did circumambulations, Geshe sort of says, "Oh, doing circumambulations is a good thing, but you might want to try practicing the real Dhamma." Say, "Oh." What do I do? So I said, circumambulations, isn't it? Maybe I better be doing prostrations. So he starts putting all his effort into doing prostrations. So. And being zealous and diligent, doing prostrations some day later, the Geshe comes past, sees him, and says, "God, doing prostrations is a good thing. But, it'd be better to practice the real Dhamma." I've put all this effort into the prostrations. Maybe I should be sort of reading and reciting the sutras. Maybe that's what he wants. Maybe that's the real Dhamma. I've not been doing it right. So, of course, the same thing. Geshe comes back and says, reading, reciting the sutras is a good thing, but it's better to practice the real Dhamma. He must want me to meditate. That's it. So then he goes and I said, meditating. And of course, the Geshe says the same thing. And he just bursts out in frustration. What? Everything I do is you keep saying that I should practice the real Dhamma. What am I supposed to do? And the Geshe said, just give up this life. Give up this life. As this simplicity, I mean, it's not sort of this is a nihilistic teaching. It's more like that giving up that kind of becoming, that being, the idea, and turning it into something to do, and allow the mind to be Dhamma. This is like Ajahn Chah saying, First you practice the Dhamma, and then you see the Dhamma, and you actually be the Dhamma. And it's just really letting the mind be with the Dhamma rather than moving, complicating, distorting. So that this sense of a giving up is an important part in that sense, not in giving up and rolling over, but relinquishment, letting go, quenching, that relinquishment, letting go. It's such a integral part of the application of a practice, and clarifying what we do. So I'll offer that for reflection this evening.
Sadhu Karandana Se Sadhu.